This is NPR Illinois. I'm Jamie Dunn. Peter Nikias covers breaking news for the Chicago Tribune. He spent 3 years on the overnight shift and during that time went to the scenes of hundreds of shootings in the city. Nikias reflected on this time and the effect it's had on his life in an essay for the September issue of Chicago Magazine titled 3 Years of Nights. I talked with Nikias about the essay and his time as an overnight reporter covering crime in Chicago.
Can you tell me a little bit about just where you get your information, how you know where to go, and then once you get there, what you're looking for?
Sure. We listen to scanners first. There's a pretty vibrant scanner community on Twitter, which helps, but it's like bad practice and poor form, I think, to rely on other people to do your work for you. So while a couple of the guys are helpful, I try to make sure to have the scanners on myself just to be able to have a good understanding of what's going on. It's not always scanners, though. Sometimes people, like sources, I guess, you call them, would text you or call you and say, hey, I heard X, Y, and Z is going on. And at that point, you can switch a radio over in case you missed it and say, and listen for yourself, you know. And it's not always shootings, but most of the scenes I've gone to have been shootings. And when you're there, you just try to keep an open mind and not prejudge the circumstances before you based on what you may have heard on the radio. It helps to have that information, but the situations are often fluid and initial reports are occasionally inaccurate. So you want to go into everything with an open mind and just try to grab somebody who might be able to fill you in on what's going on.
After you've gone to the scene, what kind of work are you doing as far as follow-up, or how much do you work with the police and that sort of thing?
If we get to a shooting scene that we think we can develop into a longer story, or one that where we've talked to the family or have like a really detailed police narrative, we try to, it takes a few things coming together to really make a story pop. You need to be able to corroborate what you've heard at the scene through public records if they exist. So whether it's a criminal history or prior incidents on the block or a chain of events that led up to a shooting, like all those things can be, there's ways to verify them through outside sources. So you're doubling back on a lot of things that you've picked up in passing. And a lot of times, like people in the neighborhood will say like, yeah, it was like 3, 4, 5 days ago, maybe 3 people got shot over here. And so to use that detail, you double back into, you know, whatever resources you have. Like we keep track of our shootings, and or you can call the police department and you say, hey, do you have another shooting on this block from such and such date? And so it's a lot of like trying to fill in the details to try and present a full picture of what's going on.
And your essay starts off with a description of your first was that your first night, your first scene?
No, I waited a few months to go out because I didn't know I was supposed to be going out. So that first night, I think it was my second.
And so you were working for a little while without going out, and then
So I was working for a while without going out, and you could always hear this like energy on the scanner sometimes. Like dispatch will say, "What's going on over there?" And then a police officer would key up and say, "This is going on over here," but you'd hear chaos in the background, whether it's an engine revving or like tons of sirens or, you know, screaming or heavy breathing. Like there was just something going on in the background. So I thought I should probably get out there and try to see what it's all about.
So then you started going out in this scene that you recount in your essay. Can you just tell me a little bit about what was going on and what it felt like being out there on one of the first scenes that you'd gone to?
Yeah, it was cold. It was February. It was, I didn't know where I was I knew where I was. I could give you the address, but I didn't know the history of the neighborhood, or I didn't realize how close it was to a police station. It was like across the street from a police station. I really didn't know what I'd be getting into. So I pulled up, and it was, I never get this feeling anymore now, but when I first started staying up through the night, I used to get this like this low key anxious feeling in my stomach where it was like, not total anxiety, but it's like, this is weird. Why are you staying up all night on purpose, you know? So I had that in my stomach a little bit. And I got there, and this officer was confused. And he was like, yo, if you drive around, you know, get a better angle on a body. So I went around, and there was still nobody there. And then the family showed up a little bit later. And I was never good at this even before I got to the Tribune. But I wasn't good at walking up to random people and saying, hey, this is who I am and I'd like to talk to you, like the man on the street type stuff. And I wasn't then, and I'm still not great at it now, but I mean, I've gotten better at it over the years, but so I awkwardly introduced myself, and they wanted nothing to do with me, which is like 99% expected. And so I gave them a couple business cards and, you know, apologized for their loss. You know, I said I was sorry for their loss. That was it.
You recount in your essay the story of a father praying over his son's body and how you kind of went back and forth on whether to include it or not, whether it was an invasion of their privacy. You ended up using it in your story, right? But how do you make those kinds of decisions?
I mean, it really was just the first decision that needed to be made. After that, it was kind of like, okay, I made myself okay with what I was doing and understanding that it was going to be uncomfortable at times. But that first one was like, I don't know, I just... Because part of it's like, look, this is an intimate moment, and some people may not appreciate that you're writing about a guy praying over his son after his son's been killed. But the flip side was, like, to me, was like, well, I think people would connect with it because it shows that people are human, and you don't get that from a lot of, like when you write a story and you're only recounting that where and when the people were shot, and there's no reaction to it. It can seem cold, and it is cold, but if you can show that, like, what a father's grief looks like, that has the potential to be powerful if you do it right. And the other part was that I wasn't the only one who witnessed it. There was other people around. There was, like residents, people getting off the train. It's sort of a busy intersection. I mean, it was off the intersection a little bit, but I was by no means the only person to have witnessed this. So I didn't feel like I'd feel more, I would have felt, I think, more conflicted about it if it was a more intimate setting. But I thought it was important to show people that, you know, violence has consequences, and it's not just about the people getting shot. It's about who they leave behind. And so I wrote it up, and I was fortunate to have editors back in the newsroom who were supportive of me doing this kind of work overnight. Because if they had said, Pete, what are you doing? Stick to the script. That probably would have ended that. But I had a couple good editors at the time. And one of them, I say had because one of them took a buyout, but the other one's still with me, which is good. I'm lucky to have him around.
You're listening to NPR Illinois. I'm Jamie Dunn. We've been hearing from Peter Nikias, a breaking news reporter for the Chicago Tribune, about his experiences covering violent crime in Chicago. He wrote about that time in his essay for Chicago Magazine called 3 Years of Nights. We will now hear more from Nikias about that essay and about the recent increase in gun violence in Chicago.
You describe kind of what it felt like to feel like you were comfortable, or at least as comfortable as you could get, being an observer overnight of crime and being in that world. And you said work had, in your essay, that work had become something that you lived and not just something that you did. Can you tell me a little bit about what that felt like, and kind of when was that a realization that happened all at once, or something that you sort of look back and realize had been going on for a while?
No, it was like a transitionary period. So when I work overnights now, I know it's not something I want to do for a very long time after I get off of this Labor Day weekend coming up. And I've only done it a couple times this summer, but I know it's like, it's not healthy for me. It messes with your sleep for a few days on each side of it. But like, it feels like when I'm driving around the city, it just feels like, okay, this is what I do. You drive around and you go to these things as they happen. And it was being like physically and emotionally unsettled by what I saw, and then realizing that it was unsettling, I think, that made me realize, like, okay, this is just how it is out here at night. You go to a crime scene sometimes and there's just this weird energy in the air, and people are acting out, and it's something there's been things overnight that are like, they're out of a movie or something, and it's not, it's real. It's just, you don't see it a lot during the day. So I realized that I had grown comfortable in this world by going to a lot of crime scenes and being tested, like having my emotions or physical response to stuff tested, and not knowing it was going to happen, and like being comfortable with how I reacted to those things, whether it's the sight of grieving relatives over dead bodies or guys getting worked on and then pronounced, all those things. There was that period of 3 or 4 weeks that summer of 2013 where we got into a lot of like weird situations, and we started getting places quicker, so we were seeing things a little bit more raw. I mean, if you go to a crime scene an hour after it happens, it looks different than if you get there 2 minutes after it happens, and we've been to both. I think if you do anything long enough, you grow comfortable with it, and that's probably just what happened. Doesn't mean you're not affected by it, but I mean, you can still carry stuff with you and be okay while it's going on, you know? And I felt like I'm still okay with things while they're going on.
You talk a little bit about this cycle of doing this over and over again and seeing this violence in the families and how that it becomes almost a routine. How do you deal with that as a person, but also as a reporter who was trying to get people to pay attention to this story and to care about it?
To avoid the feeling that, like, you're just seeing the same stuff night after night, I think part of it's unavoidable. I was driving to work this morning, and I thought to myself, like, I haven't been to a DOA homicide since, like, 4th of July, and it's nice. And so, like, just having a little bit of distance between shootings helps, because the nights that you go to 4 or 5 DOA homicides and you can't make sense of any of them because, for whatever reason, you get there and nobody wants to talk to you, or some other news pulls you away, or you're out of position when it happens, so you don't get there in time to reach the people that you need to. Like, you have nights like that where you're going to a lot of bad things and you're unable to do anything as a journalist with what you're seeing, and that's bad. But, like, that's when there's that risk for, like, everything kind of running together. The most important thing, I think, is to, like, keep an open mind so that when you get there, you just start with a blank slate and you say, okay, what do I have before me? And who is here, and who can I talk to? And you just start from scratch with everyone. Now, it's like, there's places I go where it's impossible for me to divorce what I have before me with what I've been through in the past in those neighborhoods. And sometimes it's just happenstance. Like, I happen to have 2 stories over here in this block where people were really cooperative and friendly with me. So now I have, like, some understanding of the neighborhood and the neighbors. And so there's that. But I think just keeping an open mind is important, essential. Even I would say keeping an open mind is, like, that's the main thing. I don't know if this stuff, I don't know if it's making a difference or more people are talking about it. I hope so. And it seems like on Twitter over the last few years, the audience for the work is there. And there's a community of people who are engaged in, like, solutions and, or at least talking about them, which is a start. To avoid the feeling of burnout, I guess, in the coverage even, we try to tell individual stories. And every one of them is unique. There may be similarities in broad strokes, but every single murder is unique in some way. Even if it has all the hallmarks of, you know, 100 other murders this year, they still leave behind families and affect neighbors. And it's more complicated than just a 5-paragraph story. But sometimes, even with our best efforts, that's all we can get.
So what are some of the biggest, do you think, like, misconceptions people have about what you do?
I don't even know. I almost don't want to give voice to them because they're so foolish.
What about beyond what you do? What do you think some of the biggest misperceptions are that people have about the violence?
I would say I don't know if I'd call it, like, a misconception, but people have this idea, or they bring this frame of mind to the discussion, is that the victims are the only ones affected by it. And so it's like, well, he was a gang member. He was a jerk. He was whatever. He was out at 4 a.m. Guy could be in a gang, guy could be a jerk, guy could have been out at 4 a.m. Not that being out at 4 a.m. itself should be a problem in a free society, but it can be risky. So, like, you seed all those points, right? And you say, okay, fine, the guy was engaged in risky behavior, likely involved in criminal activity, and may have even done something that provoked the violent response. Or maybe even the violent response was proportionate to what he did. I mean, there's a number of justified homicides in the city every year. There was probably 10 or 12 of them before summer even started this year. All that said, the violence, it ripples out. And this idea that it's strictly an act between the offender and the victim, or between the person shooting and the person who gets shot, that those are the only 2 people that are party to that relationship, that is absurd. You can't be in this city and not have some understanding of it, I think, or some dealing with it, whether it's on your block or in your neighborhood or a colleague's son or, you know, something. It seems like everywhere you go, people have stories of ways that they're touched by it. I think it's counterproductive to bring that mindset to the discussion. Well, it's only between the guy who got shot and the guy who did the shooting. Those are the only 2 people affected by it. Like, no, they both have families. One of them may end up going away for a long time, leaving his kids behind. Not to say he shouldn't for shooting somebody, but you have to recognize that the kids left behind that's a problem, right? That's something that society we have to deal with, is, like, how children are exposed to gun violence. There's the responders, whether it's paramedics or police officers, whether it's nurses, it's social workers dealing with children who've lost parents to either to violence or to the criminal justice system. It touches far more people than I think we often recognize. So that idea that it's only about the guy who gets shot, that's a problem to me.
You mentioned when we talked earlier that the numbers are way up this summer, and that comparing to previous years, it's a pretty big spike. So can you just tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's been a bad year. We're in late August right now, and there's been 73 homicides this month, which is a lot. There was, I think, close to 70 the month before, and a little more than 70 the month before that. We had 480 or 490 homicides all of last year, and we're approaching that number right now. I mean, barring a miracle, we're going to surpass last year's murder total in late August or early September. The number of shooting victims last year was just shy of 3,000 total, and we're approaching that number too. Probably we'll surpass that about the same time as we surpassed last year's murder totals. It's been a bad year.
Anything, I know this is like way sweeping and you probably don't have the answer, but is there anything you've observed that you think might be contributing to it being a bad year? Or?
No. I mean, I used to, like before I got this job, I used to have ideas about like, oh, only if they took the guns away, or only if they had better schools or this or that, about like things that would prevent or slow or, you know, anything that would damper the violence. But the longer I've done this, the less I feel like I know about potential solutions, if that makes sense. It's not, I mean, it's happening in the places that it's happened in years past. It's just more. So, like, you look at the 11th District, and, I mean, I checked these numbers, like, 3 or 4 weeks ago. So, but even then, 3 or 4 weeks ago, they had already passed up last year's murder and shooting totals for this one little district, right? That's, like maybe 10% or 15% of the city geography, and even less of the population, has already surpassing last year's numbers. It's just, I don't know. I wish I had an answer. I'd be suspect of anybody who says they do have an answer, because it's a complicated thing.
So I have to ask, too, because you did end your essay on an unanswered question from your wife, Erin. You said that you'd packed a lot of living into those 3 years that you worked nights, and she asked you what kind. Did you answer her? What was your answer to that?
I mean, when she said that, her eyebrows were kind of raised, and it was more of a question I think I was meant not to answer. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
She was right, though. I mean, like, it was like, I thought I had something positive to say about my last 3 years. Maybe Aaron's like, I don't know, maybe you should slow your roll a little bit and think about that. It was a fair point. It was a right. I mean, she was right. It was a different type of living than I think what I would, you know, it was a different existence than my wife had at the time or any of our friends. So, I don't know. I still think I'm better for it, but it wasn't free, you know, it came at a cost.
Do you feel like things have returned to a little bit more sense of normalcy now that you're not on overnights all the time? I know you're still doing them sometimes, but...
Yeah, things are getting... I mean, I'm still like... So you just can't get around the city as fast as you can at night during the day, so I'm going to less crime scenes. And it's still my job to go to crime scenes and still to follow up on breaking news. It's just that by nature of working days, you can't get to as many of them as you normally can. You also get to sleep at night, which is nice. So those are both good things. More important than either of those, I think, is that I've been making an effort outside of work to, like, have hobbies and respect the time that I'm supposed to have on weekends, you know? Whatever my off days are, I try to treat them like off days. That little life change has been helpful, you know, to set aside time and be like, okay, I'm going to do woodworking, or I'm going to make sure I spend a couple hours in the garden. That's been helpful.
You can find a link to Peter Nikias's essay for the September issue of Chicago Magazine at our website, nprillinois.org.